The Greenseers were more than that. They could wear the skins of any beast that flies or swims or crawls, and could look through the eyes of the Weirwoods as well, and see the truth that lies beneath the world.
Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Originally founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community. This is Season 10 of the White Book Podcast. Little wisdom from Jojen for you.
Was
more just a history lesson, but whatever.
Well, you know. Well, I'm just glad that Jojen, you know, doesn't just copy and paste his insights.
Wow, paste? That is really dark of you, Roy, considering the Jojen stew theory, which, by the way, I subscribe to.
The Jojen paste is how I've heard it referred to.
Yes, I know. I was just trying to not reuse the word paste in my gag right there.
Well, we failed miserably. It was the Jojen paste theories were when I was starting to disconnect myself from the world of Thrones theory craft.
I have not dug into it in a while. I've been pretty distracted, but this time last year, man, going down that Reddit rabbit hole, that was fun.
This time last year? The show had just ended, right? Well, it had ended in the summer?
Yeah. It had ended mid-June, I think. Something like that. So folks were really dredging up all of these wild book theories and really going off onto things about, oh, okay, well, you know, because they dropped thing X that occurs in the books and they didn't tackle it in the show, you know, here's what we think was going to happen in the books and why pulling that really detracted from the show and led to all the scaffolding falling down and all that sort of thing. So that was how I got wrapped up in it initially.
Well, we won't know until our grandchildren read the final book written by...
AI?
No, written by Daniel Abrams. Right? Is it Abrams or Abrams?
Abraham.
Abraham,
there we go. The guy that did the, the First Law trilogy? Yeah,
who's half of James
S.A. Corey.
Corey, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think Abrams' style could really pull it off. I mean, Glockta is basically Tyrion, so.
Well, yeah, and also he's a mentee of Martin, so.
Oh, I didn't actually realize that.
Yeah, they're both friends with Martin, and the other guy, who's the other half of Corey, is Martin's former assistant. So. They're part of his, like, little New Mexico group. Well.
Huh. It's always interesting to me finding out when different authors are, I don't know, actually friends with each other. I don't know why, but mentally I always think of them as much more isolated of a community from each other than like actors, right? Mm. You just sort of assume that
every A-list star knows every other A-list star or whatever. But in writing, I never quite think that way.
Yeah, but I mean, particularly genre writing, it's a small world and you need a network to get your books published, right? So,
Makes sense.
Yeah, so, I mean, one thing my time in academia taught me is that all these people know each other and have opinions on each other and have their own little feuds, both serious and unserious. So, not too different than gaming communities either.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, man.
So, Will, what are... This is not a Props and Slops episode. This is what episode of The White Book?
This is number 445, and I think we are back on schedule now after the hiccup and then double release last week. So we are back to our retrospective.
Yeah, and we are covering the fourth cycle, which was the Flight of Crows cycle, which takes us through the fourth book, right?
Yes. Yeah, because they've basically been doing two cycles a book.
No, one cycle a book, right?
One cycle book. Yes, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
So take I was thinking about how this is the second half of Bestow.
Bestow of the Bestow block, right? It's the fourth cycle, which represents the content of the fourth book, but it is the second set in the Bestow cycle. Or Bestow, excuse me, not Bestow cycle, Bestow block.
Yes.
There we go.
Yeah, Bestow block. So theoretically speaking, the first block, of course, was supposed to introduce the mechanic, ground it with the more vanilla-ish, shall we say, the straightforward type of effects. And then this block then is supposed to really show off bigger, more interesting, flashier things that that mechanic can do. So I guess we'll see whether that happens or not. Let's see. Additionally, other themes here. They also dropped the Brotherhood on us in this cycle, which I admit, if this is book four, feels a little off to me. I feel like you dropped that in book three, but oh well. They also have some good content in book four as well. So I can buy it, I suppose.
They have their big twist, right, in the fourth book into being jerks.
The Stoneheart stuff.
Yeah.
But we don't get a Lady Stoneheart, so
it's true. This entire the game didn't have Lady Stoneheart at all, right?
No, not in second edition.
Theoretically, kind of. Cat in the Stark box kind of represents Lady Stoneheart a little bit. The more, like, she gets more power and stronger, the more Starks are killed, kind of thing is like kind of. Nebulous way. I mean, we don't actually know if Lady Stoneheart is Kat. I mean, you know. Right? Because is she actually revealed as Kat?
I thought Brienne recognized
her. Brienne recognized her at the end. Right. In the fourth book. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But there's not a Brienne in this cycle either, right? It's been so long since I've
actually
read
it. There is not. Though the Tyrell box would have been queued up about the same time. So maybe they just fudged it because of that.
Yeah. There's also the sparrows is also a theme in this cycle. So it's actually
The Faith Militant.
I think there's more. Let me just double check real quick, Will. There's more Brotherhood stuff in Blood and Gold than there is. Right, there's Beric. There's actually not a lot in either cycle.
I mean, the Brotherhood without Banner's
is in that cycle, and there's Beric. But they have the same number of characters. There's one? Lem? Yeah, there's just one. Oh, Theros. Thoros, too. So there's two. So there's slightly more in this cycle. Oh, there's three, actually. Never mind.
There's also Tom, right?
Tom, man. There's also Tom. Yeah, that's weird. Interesting. But yeah, there's also the Seven theme is also seriously developed in this with the High Sparrow and Warrior Sons. And Seven-Pointed Star.
Yep. So this is what the... Well, do we want to continue in a broad strokes, or do we want to dial in on some of these specific themes? I should check that before I start dialing in on one.
let's talk. I mean, we started talking about the neutral themes, so let's start there, and then we can move into sort of... there's not a lot of clearer cycles in this cycle of cards in this set as there has been in previous ones. So it's like there's not an immediate point to hook onto. So I guess we could start talking about Brotherhood, which I don't think is a very developed theme, but I think that the Faith Militant is. So then maybe that's a good place to start. Like, what do you think of these seven characters and sort of how the seven theme is developed, Will?
That is actually the direction I was about to head down before I paused myself. Because, you know, you made a good point that the Brotherhood actually were split between the two cycles and really did not get as many pieces as I was mentally thinking. So I think then maybe that makes the whole Faith Militant Sparrows type of thing. Is that the first like very clear tribal deck that we've gotten in any of the cycles? I feel like the other stuff, like Clansmen, for instance, was in a box. And
Direwolves was technically in the core set.
But was it really presented as like a deck then, kind of prepackaged, or at least with enough to really push it?
I mean,
or was
as
it
much
just
as
a couple of Direwolf cards?
I mean, there was Summer, Greywind, the puppy, the location that gives them all ambush, the event that pays you off for playing them. I mean,
okay, so that's a pretty good set. That's probably enough to really.
Yeah, I think Dothraki and Direwolves were kind of the only tribes that were sort of like supported out of the go with enough cards that like, I mean, whether or not you could actually like build a good Direwolves deck or a good Dothraki deck for most of them.
I'm not necessarily saying good, but is there enough that you can really build specifically toward that theme if you want to, whether it's competitive or not?
I definitely think that those are the two that start with out of box. And then I do think that this is the first one that a cycle really pushes. It's also the first, and before excluding the bin pack, I believe the only one that's pushed by an agenda, right?
That is specifically referenced by the agenda.
Yeah, yes. That's the agenda says you must. Oh, no, that's not true. Maesters. Maesters is the other one.
Yeah, yeah. Though we don't get that for a while, right?
No, we get that. That's the next box that we're going to talk about. That's Conclave is in the Tyrell box, right? Okay. Or is it not
within the context of this cycle? Then at least is
correct.
I suppose all I am really going for.
Conclave is in the Tyrell box. So we'll talk about it next time.
Even the Brotherhood agenda does not specifically need say. Brotherhood. It just needs non-loyal. Free Folk also does not specifically need Wildlings, right?
I think it does, actually.
Oh, dang it.
That's right.
Two words. It is specifically Wildlings. So. Yeah.
So those are the three then. So it's Conclave, Free Folk, and this one. And this is the first. Plus the Knight's Agenda in the bin pack.
Right. Though, you know, that was never even on FFG's end build to be part of the main second edition game the same way. So I don't know if we should count the bin pack.
We can decide that when we get there.
That's fair. That's fair.
So I think Faith Militant has always been one of the biggest trap agendas, I think, that they've ever printed. It's cool, or is at least, maybe if not cool, it's very like interesting, and it definitely pulls you to build around it. But it's never quite there. And now people have built some really cool Faith Militant decks. You know, probably like the mainstays are like Tyrell Faith Militant, Barra Faith Militant. And I've seen a really cool Martell Faith Militant that was played by some players.
Martell? I don't think I've seen that one.
Yeah, that was built around like being really obnoxious with the High Sparrow and control cards.
Gotcha.
So back also when the economy was really flooded as well. So like High Sparrow and somebody flips, you know, Trade Routes. Or God, what I was playing against High Sparrow once. They're
planning on getting 14 gold and they only get 7.
Yep. 10th was 10-3-1 or 10-2-1.
Trading with the Pentoshi.
Trading with the Pentoshi, which screwed me. That kind of stuff. So, but it just never quite got there. And Danny keeps pushing it. Like later on, we'll run into what's the two drop called that's in the Shadow Cycle that gain a power, draw a card. Your opponent gets to choose. That is called.
Drat. I should remember that. Poor fellows,
yes. And poor fellows and sparrows. And even though sparrows decks later come out into being, they end up not being based on this agenda, really. I think the most successful sparrows decks aren't about this agenda.
Just for what it's worth, did we clarify, we keep referencing the sparrows as the in-universe or one of the in-universe groups that falls under the heading of the Faith Militant, which is...
I'm actually talking about literally
the title of the actual sparrows card. Oh, you're literally speaking the sparrows card. Okay.
Yes, the sparrows card. You're right.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure, since the cards as the theme are... mention the seven, right. But sparrows are also a lot wider group. Okay, you meant specifically that card.
Yeah, I got you. What I'm saying is, Danny, both of those cards are super freaking pushed, right? That come later. And they still don't make this agenda work entirely and consistently. So why do you think that is, Will? Like, why do you think the Faith Militant, even as it clearly becomes something FFG wants you to play, like it screams in this cycle, again, there's one... 2, 3, 4, 5. I think there's also like a Tyrell card. Yeah, there's Septimus of 6. Minimum 6, 7 cards. I mean, there's other ones I'm sure that I'm missing here. There's at least 7 cards that support it in this set. So, like, why do you think it didn't work well?
I think there's a variety of factors at play here. One is the faction kneel that's necessary to trigger this agenda. Any agenda that requires the faction kneel better have a very high upside to offset the cards you're not playing that would otherwise utilize that. In this case... you cause a 2-power swing. I mean, yes, theoretically that's nice, but is it better than the giant strength boost and additional power that you would get from, say, Lords of the Crossing and not have to deal with the faction kneel and the restriction that your non-seven characters cannot gain power, which I feel like renown or some way of gaining power is much more widespread throughout the factions in second edition than it was in, say, first edition, and that it's a much more relevant ability. Now, some of that is due to tweaks to the game, like to dupes and that sort of thing, making characters stickier, which makes the power on them stickier. So I think not allowing them to get power is a big trade-off. And virtually all, the big new ones we get pushed on us anyway, of the seven characters are all neutral, which then really constrains the other effects that you can include in your deck. I seem to remember at about this time, there were still folks playing the house-specific reducers, both the zero-cost locations and the Chud one-drop characters. None of those could be used on the big push for seven characters. The top end of the seven characters as well then just didn't have the same like oomph in challenges. You know, you're looking at say a Warrior Sons at five, and it's just a wildly different level of impact to the challenge phase than say a Knight of Flowers or an Asha or something like that. You're getting kind of a middling control effect. I guess that's really what a lot of their effects boil down to, is middling control effects, but they're just kind of scattershot, like in what they do and how they relate to each other.
Absolutely. And I think another thing you're missing here a little bit is some of the big, powerful seven cards, like the High Sparrow, which is one of the big thematic wins of this set. It's an incredibly well-designed card on the thematic level, and I think it's an incredibly interesting card to build around, and I think that decks that are built around the High Sparrow end up being really cool, but it's kind of at war with what the Faith Militant is doing, right? So, because, like, what is the High Sparrow does nothing for challenges for you, or make it more likely that you will be able to win those challenges. To a lesser extent, like a slap you around 5-for-5 body of Warrior Sons can help you, but there's not really a lot of seven tools that are about winning challenges, as you said. And then, of course, a lot of the effects, like in Stark or in Tyrell and Greyjoy as well, like some of their best strength pumps require you to have that faction's identity, right? It requires you to be a Stark card or a Greyjoy card or a Tyrell card. I think Tyrell has the most, you know, just sort of generic strength pumps, but still their best strength pump card, Growing Strong, you know, 1 for 6 additional strength spread out across 3 bodies. That card, you know, requires Tyrell cards. That's kind of at war with itself. And I think the fact that there wasn't enough seven payoffs in the factions themselves to interact with. And so like,
that's a big one.
So like Conclave, I think, is a really good example that eventually got there. Somewhat on the back of the neutral cards that really give you a reason to buy it or play it. But also there was enough in faction maesters, and the fact that Conclave gave you the ability to play out of faction maesters as well, again, gives you that you have a wide enough pool that you can, you know, take the opportunity cost of having to find, you know, 11 playable or 12 playable maesters, right? It's 12. We'll talk more about this.
I think it's 12, just like Alliance requires.
Yeah. And, you know, which is a huge opportunity cost, but it gets to the point where like you're willing to pay that cost because the payoff effects are high enough, both from what the agenda gives you and what the access to the few busted maesters cards give you. The Faith Militant never quite gets there, because, again, this sort of like vaguely kind of rushy, kind of passive powery,
effect is just like not and kind quite of controlly
as well.
Yeah, it's like it's a card pull at war with itself. And while there are going to be like one, this set has one of them in the form of the High Sparrow, and later sets will have really powerful seven cards. It never coheres into a deck, and that is a real tragedy. Another card that never really coheres into a deck, despite the fact that I played this agenda at one of a big tournament. Thank
Greensight.
You. Is Greensight. Yes. you know, a former co-host of ours here was, you know, one of the biggest promoters of this agenda for a long time. And it's another agenda that screams play, right? But it never quite gets there again. It keeps almost getting there. Like Night's Watch Greensight, was always threatening to be very good. Once Night's Watch reached its max of the Steelio stuff cards, mm-hmm. and then the mill deck out of Tyrell that the Humberts popularized was also, one of those. What do you think about Green?
Wasn't there a Lanny mill deck pushed by one of the Brits as well?
Oh, by wasn't it pushed by Bamford? I think it was.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. So what do you think about Greensight?
It's just kind of like tragically, underpowered and bizarrely narrow of scope for such a generic effect. I mean, it runs into the same faction Neil problem, right? And it doesn't actually provide any benefit of its own to you in gameplay the way any other agenda does, most all of them. I suppose the Alliance or the Banner stuff don't.
Here's where I disagree with you, though, there, Will. Because I think because this is such a narrowly specific effect, effects that trigger off of it are always going to want it in a way that, but in a way that Faith Militant, for example, it doesn't have an effect that really screams to you, look for cards that pay off for this effect, right? But Greensight does literally get in your face like a drunk, frat boy at a party and scream in your face that you should look for effects that trigger off either cards being in your discard pile, your opponent's discard pile, or you're paid off for milling them.
Yes. But I guess part of what I'm thinking of then is, as far as the narrow scope is, looking at some of those decks, they are either something a very specific in-deck end goal that is more specific, like the Night's Watch Steel stuff, right? It might be fine on its own. This might dump something useful. It might not. Versus things like the mill decks or pillage decks or raiding decks, whatever you might want to call them, that are trying to get to emptying their opponent's deck as an endpoint. But this doesn't really hook on to any of that stuff. So I guess my mind was more thinking about there were these other decks that used a lot of these effects that didn't really do anything other than the endpoint of, well, once their 60 is now zero, okay, that did something, but it didn't interact along the way. So I think maybe I got wrapped up mentally on that as opposed to, say, trying to utilize your own flea bottom or something, though there's probably much more straightforward ways to do that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the more interesting things, and one of the design spaces that Thrones, I'm surprised, never really explored,
Although, I guess that's not true. Drowned God really does it. But when it comes to discard pile, there's not a huge amount of, like, mill yourself a bunch to put cards in your discard pile for some kind of payoff, which a lot of other, because Design Space, a lot of other cards, card games explore. And I'm just surprised that Thrones never really went there. It does that with the dead pile.
Well, second ed Thrones doesn't.
Right.
I feel like first ed did much more.
That's true. There's an attempt with that with the Martell card that's in the Shadow Cycle that got really redesigned by Hanno. Mission to Essos is like kind of vaguely trying to do that and play around with that. It's interesting. You know, Targ also kind of has like your discard pile matters theme sort of, or play out of the discard pile, but never really gets into it, which I think Mina towards Greensight is, I've played it in two contexts. One, at Thrones War, this would have been the last Thrones War in person. So that would have been 2019. Yeah. 2019. And, I played it because we thought that the Fat Cat deck was broken, and so my team at that Thrones War played many copies of that, and we tried to play as many as possible, and we needed agendas that were good, and there were only two really good agendas, Fealty and Reigns, and we gave those to the players best with that deck, and I, as the leader, took one of the less optimal agendas, Greensight, because I just basically used Greensight as a, like, looking for cat and other combo pieces, and okay, and sort of just getting my deck down to where I would draw cat, and it was okay to do that. The other time, of course, I played it is playing it in a mill deck, and I really think that that's, as much as I really love milling, and I was one of the few people who, like, was really happy when that deck became legal, became possible. But it showed that probably why they never should have printed Greensight, because I think that because, you know, it left it open for Danny to print cards that did pay off of you milling yourself, but those cards never materialized. And in the context of what did materialize, this card was never going to be fair. So it's either good. So it's not really design space that was worth printing on an agenda, as cool as this effect could be sometimes, I guess. Like, I think it's like one of those effects that's dangerous, even if this card seems kind of like not dangerous on the surface. Sort of like actually how the Three-Eyed Crow works. And it has gorgeous art. That's another one.
It does have gorgeous art. The whole stained glass theme for agendas is definitely
after the first cycle
little nod that I really liked. The first cycle did not, I guess.
Crossing's original art doesn't have stained glass, right? I think it was after. I think it was actually Alvaro's card that did it. It was the first one that had that like stained glass art.
Gotcha.
I could be wrong.
Let's see. There was no agenda in the Stark box, right?
Correct.
Nope. Was there one in... Oh, okay. The Kings of... Nope. Kings of Summer and Winter were the first ones.
Were the first ones? Okay, cool.
Yeah. So there's only one agenda outside the core set that doesn't have the stained glass thing then. That
would Lord be... Lord of the Crossing.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So do we want to talk about House of the Red Door then?
Sure. I think it's very important to hit these three agendas, because I also feel like this is finally right about the time where we've gotten enough agendas in the pool with enough interesting abilities that people were able to really start experimenting and having fun with some much more different stuff. And then House of the Red Door goes and multiplies those possibilities by the very nature of its ability.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good agenda to be printed. I'm really happy that it it was printed. So I guess this is a moment to sort of let in a little bit of the playtesting process. One of the designed purposes was to the 1.0 version of this card, which was called House of Dreams, right?
Yes.
Was ubiquitous, you might say, in first edition, Will. Would you say by the end of the game?
Yeah, but not overpoweringly so. I mean, like it was more than 50% of the meta, but it was always there to be accounted for.
Right, and always a pretty powerful, like every faction had multiple very powerful decks for House of the Red Door, right? And or the House of the Red Door, House of Dreams, right? And of course the finals of the final 1.0 was two Cori agendas versus each other. House of the Dreams
with different agendas, right?
Yeah. Harrenhal, right? Stark Harrenhal versus Dark Wings, Dark Words. But it just shows you again how busted Corey's agendas were in first edition.
Shakes fist at Cori.
But I think, and of course, one of the things that House of the Red Door, like you say, House of Dreams in first edition did was it was very powerful and it required a certain kind of interaction when it became really good, right? And the times when it was really good, it kind of warped the meta around itself, right? When those decks became kind of ubiquitous. And then once the meta kind of warped itself around, you play certain kinds of plots to make sure you could hit your opponent's House with the Red Door location. And if you could do that, they would frequently lose very quickly.
City plots.
Yep. And then, you know, then when the meta sort of then self-corrected back, okay, HOD decks have been pushed out, then HOD decks could come back in. And it was very, like, a very warping agenda. Is that a fair analysis as someone who came into sort of the tail end of first edition of what HOD did in the meta?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends a little bit, or at least how warping that was, depends a little bit on your definition of when that type of thing is a problem and when that is the natural ebb and flow of a metagame that propels forward motion. I don't feel that it reached a problem warping point, particularly thankfully because it was not an agenda that warped games in a mirror match. Those self-warping agendas, I think, are always a problem, or self-punishing, depending on how that goes. But thankfully, we didn't really get into that realm in second ed. So
unless you played a Dragon Pit Mirror in first edition.
Yes, there you go. That is definitely possible.
but one of the goals in playtesting was to make the card less ubiquitous, and I think in that they succeeded. Now the open question is whether they succeeded too well.
Maybe a touch too well. I'm not sure the changes that were made accounted for the location base of second ed.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly the expanded cost curve, meaning there's some four cost locations that can't be used here. I mean, or maybe that was specifically tailored.
That was specifically. I mean, this is about making so people sure can't play HRD Wall. Like, that's
sure
100%
or the Arbor HRD Arbor.
Arbor.
But also other.
Well, you can never do it, right? You can never do HRD or HOD, right? Limited. Like, it was always excluded and limited.
Oh, actually, yes, you are right. I had forgotten that HOD did exclude limited. So there go my dreams all over again.
Right. And I think that HRD, I think the problem was what the restrictions, particularly the setup.
Yeah.
Cost.
The expanded cost curve of second ed really fiddles with setup on this.
And that means that you need, it kind of narrows the amount of HRD locations that are going to be successful, because they need to be something that gives you such an overwhelming advantage that it truly is worth the cost. Like, I guess you could say that that's a benefit in the sense that it means you really do have to commit to the agenda in a way that and the location in a way that, like, you didn't necessarily have to with HOD. Like, for example, I played HOD LIV2, which the agenda was kind of like an advantage on the first turn, and you could really lock people out of games, but it wasn't like, really, if you just kind of just played it as a Greyjoy aggro deck, you kind of could just do it that way, right? The agenda was kind of a yes and to what the deck's game plan was, not really saying, oh my god, I must have this agenda to make the deck successful. In the way in which, because of that 4-gold limit, HRD basically demands, no, you really got to commit. And that means something like Marine, which means you're going to be constantly drawing cards, and having that on set means you're going to have card advantage for the entire game. And of course, Targ does have some good lower cost characters that make the setups a little less painful. In Night's Watch, you know, the builders decks really, there's always a debate of whether HRD gift was worth it or not, you know, but there's a lot of cheap builders. Plus you could also do HRD. You could do wall as your setup alongside gift. And that could really, really speed you up. What's another major? Oh, Starfall. Again, like, Starfall is such a powerful control effect that it could, like, turn off your opponent's, you know, first turn, which would give you time to catch up. I'm trying to think of other big Dragon Pit, which, again, of course, having Pit from turn one, again, Targaryen, one low curve, good low crop, some of the best two cost characters in the game, plus having the ability to make your opponent's characters die. Like, you can flip into Blood of the Dragon on the first turn and kill your opponent's cards. And the fact that Shadows synergizes really well with HRD again shows it. But, like, there were certain factions that, like, HRD never hit on a competitive level with, like Greyjoy, Stark, right? I'm trying to think.
Well, in Joust or Melee, it definitely hit in Melee.
In Joust, I'm thinking of course. Let's see what else. Baratheon, you know, did get it. It had some really powerful locations. Tyrell, and I've seen HRD Old Town decks, but it was never really worth it. Can you think of other Tyrell?
Tyrell of Old Town would have been my first guess. I feel like, again, maybe in Melee, I saw somebody fiddling with Arbor Queen before. But Joust, I don't think it ever really... I mean, Tyrell's big location strength in Joust is limited, so...
Mm-hmm. And a four-cost location that we'll get to.
Oh, right. The other one, yep.
Yeah, so I think all of those decks are sort of all in on their HRD location, and they kind of have to be because the opportunity cost is so high. Now, you could argue that that's good because it means that HRD decks play in a unique way. It makes it, again, not just a good stuff agenda. It means, you know, although some of the decks that came out with HRD really were just good stuff decks with, you know, like Marine is kind of the nightmarish version of, like, what this agenda is capable of. But overall, I think it ends up being just not as impactful as House of Dreams was because the opportunity cost is so high for most factions. Again, excluding Targaryen, I think, which is the faction that kind of, like, runs away with this agenda.
To flip back here. There we go. Dang. I was trying to find what was the Greyjoy event. Because I'm thinking about one of the other weaknesses is kind of an oddity. But then I think turned out to be a very real factor. What was the Greyjoy event that can actually bounce the location out of play?
Oh, Raiding the Bay of Ice.
Yes, thank you. Because, of course, the original House of Dreams in first edition, did it say that? How was it phrased? Was it
immune to your opponent's card effects?
Yeah. Yeah. So
plots could affect it, but.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
It was non-plot effects, I think is what it was. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of the shielding effect was really stripped down here to just can't be discarded. So, of course, it could be blanked by attachments and it could be bounced back to or out of play, back to top of deck, I think, is where that Greyjoy event went.
Yeah, so it could be pillaged, right? It's a pillage support card. Yeah, that's definitely the case. And definitely Froso was sad. Sad times for HRD players.
Or another card here in this set.
Seized by the Guard.
Yeah, exactly. That became extremely popular.
When Marine was everywhere.
That might be transitioning us into how Bestow in this cycle went. So I don't know if we're ready to make that leap or not.
There's a couple of plots I think we want to make sure that we talk about here, but definitely I think talking about Bestow in a big way is definitely worth it.
Sure. Since we're in the neutral stuff, do you want to hit those plots before we move on to Bestow? Because that probably runs the gamut for Bestow.
Yeah, I mean, we can't talk. I mean, this is a set full another of
champ card. Is that the one you're looking at?
No, I was going to start with an even more impactful card. I think it's definitely, okay. I think, one of the best design cards in the set. I think. It's a shame, really, that this card was not discovered earlier in the game's life cycle. I think it really would have improved second edition. That's Valador Harris. In a set that's full of really powerful cards, like I believe the one we'll want to talk about, King in the North, and Windai, these are the three plots we were talking about. These are all massively powerful cards, but I think Valador Harris is really an elegant solution to some of the issues that we were talking about the cost curve, because the way in which it plays specifically around a sort of like fixed amount of gold that allows you to play some with seven cost characters. But if your plan is entirely to go all in on seven cost characters, Valador Harris can extremely punish you, but it's not so punishing that it kills the characters. So it, you know, it just puts them at the bottom of the deck. So you're not entirely, you know, punished for running multiple seven cost characters. So I really think that Valador Harris really hits the sweet spot of the tensions are all at the right place. The gold is good. The initiative is solid. The still got one claim. The reserve is acceptable. And the reset is powerful and impactful, but not in a way that really blows somebody out. It can really flip a game around, but it can't really blow you out. So I think it really is the perfect second edition reset.
I mean, I don't think I can naysay virtually anything that you said there. I think we certainly by proxy of Aaron early in the show's run were heavily influenced by Aaron's love of what was the draft version
Bloody called? Flux, I believe.
Bloody Flux or the Pale Mare?
It might be the Pale Mare. You're right. It's the Pale Mare. Yes.
Yeah. Pale Mare. Ever so slightly different stats. I think higher initiative, right?
And killed. That's the big difference.
Oh, and it killed. It killed. Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
But close enough in scope and effect that I think on this show we had been pretty much shilling for this for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was a great addition and just hit that sweet spot that it was impactful without being everywhere. You know, I definitely considered it a lot. A lot of times would include it as a second reset along with something else, which which I think is something that second edition had kind of finally gotten to the point of by this time, where you could run multiple resets and kind of hammer different axes of the character base on consecutive terms to kind of keep your opponent off balance and flipping back and forth. And that was something that I personally really enjoyed.
Yeah, the double valor plot decks were pretty ubiquitous for a while, and there were still many decks that still utilized it, right? I think Valid-O-Harris provided, like, what I like about Valid-O-Harris is it both provides control decks with an additional tool, but also is good in a mid-range mirror. That way, like, a lot of, like, Morghulis isn't really necessarily, you know, and particularly the fact that it says it cannot be saved, you know, means that it really creates much more interesting tensions in mid-range mirrors than Morghulis does, which is very much like who saw their saves for their best dudes first. While Do-Harris is, you know, the tension on the board, what do you put under, what's in your hand, like, and also one of the things I really like about Valor Do-Harris and its tension with Valor Morghulis is Do-Harris punishes you for playing multiple big characters with dupes, while Morghulis, you know, encourages you to play, when you play your big characters, to have dupes, right? Mm-hmm. So, and the ability to sort of, like, the interplay and the tension that creates of, like, as a play experience, I think is so cool. Like, I
agree.
And I think it really, really refreshed the game and raised the skill cap of the game a lot. In a good way. And a subtle way.
Right, right. Not an easily abused way, but an important one to consider and plan. It's something that really amped up the plot game, so to speak. And, like you said, also even the marshalling game. Mm-hmm. And really emphasize that forward thinking and planning and kind of setting up future turns, plot reveals, and that sort of thing, which is a huge chunk of what makes Thrones so unique. So I think it was a great addition.
Cool. Well, do we want to talk about a card that was not a great addition? No offense, Jakob.
I thought you were going to say You Win or You Die.
Man, I was going to go King in the North.
I'm so close.
King in the North has one clause too many. So.
Which one do you think is the one that's too far? Or do you just not care just as long as any single one was dialed back?
If it read, players cannot trigger abilities on characters' locations or attachments, this card would be much more balanced and much more interesting and much better.
Oh, without the king caveat?
Correct.
Gotcha. I thought you meant remove either characters or locations or attachments.
No. I get it. I think that, and I think I've said that, I think I said this in the show when King of the North was ubiquitous. Like, one of the things I like about what the effect, like King of the North or what it was called in first edition Burning Bridges, does is it makes event interaction much more important, and the ability that, like, you can catch up on it. You can, if you can interact with events in the form of nightmares or growing strong or the Stark event that everyone hates, what's it called?
Oh, I Am No One.
I Am No One. Like, there's all these different, like, event interactions that get around King in the North and encourages you to have some of those cards in your deck when an effect like King of the North is in the meta. And I think that's a really cool tension to create in deck building and create in play. What I don't like is that King clause that basically means, like, if I play Renly early and you don't have a King in your deck, or you didn't draw your Renly early, I'm going to, pardon my French, fuck you. And I'm going to, and it's not going to be fun for anyone but me. This is going to be completely, you know, fun for me and no fun for you. And the fact that there are some factions that just simply do not have access to kings,
Yeah, that's probably the biggest one for me.
Is super obnoxious. And so that's sort of why I don't like this card. And I think it was a poor addition to the game, because of the ways in which, again, it can enable combo because you slap Crown of Golden Roses on your combo piece and you can do whatever you want in King of the North, but your opponent can't interact. Again, super obnoxious and really just unfun and one-sided in other way. I think that this would be a really cool card if it just didn't have that caveat.
Gotcha. I can see that. I of course was not privy to the playtesting chatter at the time on this, but I know there are a variety of king related effects. It seems like that's a trait they didn't want to push it as far as, say, a tribal theme, but definitely wanted to be very, very much on people's minds in second edition. So I sort of see how they landed on the interaction here. Mm-hmm. But I can agree that the way it played out did not wind up being all that balanced.
Yeah. Well, Will, you really hate Win or Die, so...
yeah, I mean, it's, I am a bit of two minds about it. I'm not all hate here. I mean, to some extent, the Shaga in me loves this type of thing, right? You see a lot of big flashy numbers and you're just like, whoa, this thing is just like a huge haymaker. Even the Ned in me says, okay, this is an interesting way to interpret you win or you die. Like, you either use those two cards or you lose everything with that zero reserve. Okay, you know, that's a fun interpretation. But it's just too much. It's too efficient. It's just wildly blows out the scale of other plots in the game. Just wildly. I don't know how much more to specifically say about it other than it's above the curve on card advantage, income, initiative, and claim. It's like literally everything except for reserve, which means you get to do a lot with all of those other stats and effects before that reserve ever matters. And it may not even really matter.
Yeah. So this card is, I think it was an experiment worth having. Because it's in a, like, we have to remember just like how mediocre two claim plots were before this was printed, right?
Retaliation. Didn't we just talk about it?
We did say that. We did say that, yes.
And we said it was like the perfect second ed two claim.
I agree. And I think that the goal here is to try to create like a real closer plot. For faction, particularly for aggro decks. So for like an aggressive Stark deck or an aggressive Greyjoy deck, to sort of create like that effect you were saying, Will, that's like thematically, you win or you die. Like, you get all the gold you need. You get to announce what the initiative is. You know, you're going to get set the task of the turn, and you'll have two claim, and you'll draw two cards. So you're going to see four new cards, bare minimum. But you're going to discard count to zero cards. That ended up, I think at first, that's kind of how Win Die was played. And it was okay at first. But I think there was two things that would, over time, really became clear. First, that the fact that you draw two cards in Thrones means that if you...
By default, yes.
So if you can position yourself into having an extremely strong board state, it doesn't matter that you don't have any cards in your hand going into the draw phase, because you're going to see two fresh cards. And that, like, the fact that there's a lot less of an opportunity cost than we thought in playtesting, you know, as more games were played with it, it became clearer that you know, it really what that the zero reserve wasn't as much of a loss as we were hoping.
It didn't turn out to be you win or you die.
Right. It was more you win and you win.
I was more thinking about you win or you wander into the kitchen and stare at the refrigerator and forget what you went in there for.
I think it's more like you win this turn or you win next turn. Like, it's frequently like win dies. And the that so that increases it becoming ubiquitous. Like, and the moment where it becomes a parody is the fact that it is in the World Championship Control Deck. Control Deck. The winner of Worlds, playing Martell Wolf Control, played a plot with zero reserve. Which so goes against what a control deck should want to do. Because as reserve-raising plots, or reserve-raising effects, were printed... Summersea Port being the worst offender of this, but also there's some Night's Watch cards that do it too. And then, of course, Dorne is going to make it just even more obnoxious. So the fact that there's sort of two factions and two factions that can play a sort of game that have as a gameplay style that entirely breaks the tensions in this card, at that point just becomes a parody of itself. And so... this card, while I do think it was a worthwhile experiment, I think that it should teach future designers to be really careful with what you think the opportunity, like how much of a cost a lot of opportunity costs actually are, particularly when it comes to reserve. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. And they should have restricted it slash banned it much earlier than it was.
That, also agreed. Yeah.
Because I think that there's some cards, I think there's some experiments that are worth having. And you should be willing to either A, let them rotate, or B, ban them. Because there's just some, it's sometimes better to just push the envelope and miss sometimes, as long as you're not always missing and every card is broken. Than to just print a bunch of boring cards that no one wants to play.
Yeah. I think partly maybe this escaped for so long is because it just feels very vanilla. I mean, it's a vanilla that's been dialed up to 11, but the individual effects are not some crazy... impactful, wordy, you know, difficult to parse, easy to abuse, you know, type of six cost wall sort of thing, right? It doesn't draw attention the same way. It's just really, really efficient.
Yes. And again, that opportunity cost ends up not being an opportunity cost at all.
Right.
So on to Bestow. Do you have any thoughts about where Bestow ends up?
Gosh, I think this in general, this set honestly mostly just does more of the same with Bestow, much more than I was expecting. I definitely was expecting more to really kind of shake things up, like. Saltcliff Sailor, maybe, I think is a good example of a very interesting way to expand Bestow, to hook on to it, to allow you to move these tokens, the gold tokens, of course, around and tangibly, physically interact with them, as well as mechanically interacting. Like, that is a card that pushes what Bestow means and shows what all you can do with the mechanic, but we didn't get a lot of that.
Yeah, I agree. I think looking over these Bestow cards, there's some real hits that really do make Bestow. There's some really interesting and useful explorations of Bestow. Of course, Seized by the Guard is, uh-huh. you know, one of them.
That's the one we almost transitioned into Bestow with a little while ago.
Yeah. And I think Saltcliff Sailor is also one that I think you were wise to hit. There was one other one that I wanted to mention.
As a hit?
As a hit, yes.
Okay.
House of Black and White, which is, I think, one of the probably... In the last episode, I talked about how I dislike refilling, self-refilling Bestow cards. Mm-hmm. But I think that the tensions in this card are really cool.
It is definitely one of those weird ones that kind of expands what you can do right. with.
It doesn't do refilling in like a boring, like, win a challenge, put one more gold on it. Ooh, okay. You know, remove a gold plus one strength. For something, win a challenge, put another gold on it, like a lot of, you know, people seem to think are interesting Bestow effects. This, you know, there's a lot of tension going on here. Like, if you put too little gold on it at first, it's only able to kill smaller things, but then you got to make sure that you, when you refill it, you have enough gold to refill it properly. It's cool card. Like, I think it's definitely one of the big hits.
Well, and I think you make a good point there about refilling, not just filling, which I think it hooks onto part of what I like about Saltcliff Sailor is you are manipulating those gold tokens. You're taking them off and putting them on, and physically interacting with them. Which I think is more interesting than just you want to challenge, put another token on. Like, that's just renown.
Absolutely.
I mean, but with gold tokens, but whatever.
Yeah, but overall, I actually think Bestow is a big miss in this cycle. I think a lot of the Bestow cards are kind of like, bleh. They're not.
You're looking at Brightwater Knight, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a spoiler from Will and I's pre-game discussion. There's like, really, like, why is... This doesn't do anything interesting. This should have been in the first cycle because this is sort of like a very basic Bestow design. Mm-hmm. And it's just as bad as the similar Lannister one that's in that cycle, except this one means you can only do knights. Like Yunkai is also one that's kind of bad.
It played badly, but I think the effect is interesting in the same way the House of Black and White is.
Theoretically, it just plays really poorly. Like, yeah. And it's also like a weird stealing from Tyrell effect. It's Pie Bleed 2.
If that had been the Tyrell Bestow card instead of the Brightwater Knight, oh, that would have been cool. Also, did each house literally only get one Bestow card in this second Bestow cycle?
No, because Night's Watch got two at the bare minimum. Got Obsidian Arrows and Molestown, so.
But I, glancing at the others real quick, Stark also got two. They got Host of the Riverlands and
House of Black. I think they all actually got two.
I guess that maybe I just missed what the other Tyrell one was at a quick look.
No, maybe some of them didn't get two.
Okay. It feels like less Bestow cards when I really get into it than I would have expected.
Yes, absolutely. And, speaking of Night's Watch, though, Molestown, I hate this card. Like, I hated it when it was printed. I hate it now. I hate people. Like, I got in so many arves on two teams Night's Watch about this card, and everyone is just always like, Molestown. Molestown is the most results-oriented card in the world. And it is... So many people are like, my Molestown won me the game. And I'm like, okay, but what about all the games where you put it on their tie win, and then you couldn't Molestown them again the next turn? I hate this card. This card is so bad.
From a flavor perspective, shouldn't it be taking gold off of the characters and putting it on Molestown?
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's this, like, I think Barra got a weird bestow hate card that kind of went nowhere and did nothing. And I don't think they have any bestow themselves.
Which was the hate card they got?
Lysenny Pirate. While you control a warship location, Lysenny Pirate gains stealth. Oh. Reaction. After you win a challenge and Lysenny Pirate is attacking, move one gold from the losing opponent's gold pool or a card that player controls to your gold pool.
Yeah,
I don't think they got any bestow cards. So I would over say that kind of, I think maybe, I also think that some of the ways in which, like, why bestow has kind of a low reputation in the faction, or in the faction, excuse me, in the community, is that this cycle does such a poor job really pushing bestow and really rethinking what it could do and really exploring what I mean, my love letter to bestow as a theoretical mechanic was in the last time. I won't really rehash it here, but like treating it as like that cool modular design space. There's like the most successful bestow card here, Seized by the Guard, does that.
Yeah.
You know, some of the like, and then there's some ones that are kind of like playing around with it, like Iron Bank. And the
Iron Bank is at least another very like Shaga WoW card. Even if it doesn't get there on a Jamie front,
it was almost always there on a Jamie front. It just like it's an interesting card because it's so vulnerable to so much hate, and well, like all location hate in the world hits it. And if you see it late in the game, it just doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
So, like, and you can't set it up. That's another thing.
And it won't work with the house with the red door.
Right. So. Or ambush. So, yeah. I think it's a decent attempt, though. But, like, you can look at, like, bad cards like Great Sip of Baelor. And there's just, like, much more air here than should be. Like, theoretically, by this point, design should have a much better sense of, like, what's the interesting design space to be explored in bestow. And they have some of that. Again, House of Black and White, which we talked about. And then there's some good sort of, like, just good bestow cards on a basic level, like Seized. But there should be way more of that at this point.
It almost feels like, for some reason, design decided to specifically to pull away from bestow. The smattering of what we've got now almost reads to me as, okay, here were the slush file cards left over from brainstorming cycle one, mm-hmm. that we didn't put in there. And well, we've got half a dozen left. We will shove them into the second set. I have nothing to go on there. I have no inner workings
or
playtest or insight, but it's the vibe I get from the content of the set.
Definitely. I agree. And I think that you're right, Will. And that's not even saying playtesting. That was never explicitly said in playtesting, but I get the feeling that that's kind of where they were, that like maybe design's like, well, there isn't as much design space. And I just strongly disagree with that, and I hope I made the case, and I really do hope, if any of the future designers are really listening, I really hope your takeaway here is that, one, bestow is a really powerful modular mechanic, and you really should explore and dig into that and the way it interacts with both house themes, and there's still some generically good designs that were not done. And then there's also the fact that they're self-refilling bestow cards look to House in Black and White, look towards the effects of something like Yunkai, and not just something that just says some small incidental effect a player already wants to do causes mm-hmm. it to refill. Like, that's where I think bestow should be pushed by future designers, and I think that there's a huge amount of design space. That can be, you know, can be explored here.
Yeah. So I agree. Criminally underutilized, but due to that, I don't know if there's much more to say about the specifics of it in this set, unless there's another particular card you were really wanting to hit.
So I want to talk kind of broadly about the card pool in this set, and then I want to narrow into a couple of sort of important themes that really take off with the release of this cycle. First, I want to say that this is a high power cycle. Each faction, except for one, Will, which faction is it that doesn't have at least one card that lands?
In this set?
Mm-hmm. There's all...
Oh.
Like, every faction has at least one card that lands, and it's very easy to...
What am I... Oh, Lannister?
Lannister. I don't think there's a single Jaime card
here. I had scrolled right past Lannister. When you put me on the spot, I'm looking back and forth and not even, like, looking at their cards.
Sir Pounce is like, fine. I love Sir Pounce, like, as a design.
Sam is going to riot when he listens to this episode.
I think Sir Pounce is a really well-designed card thematically, and it's pretty cool. It's just, like, never, like, I guess Lanny Valerian Steel it lands in. I played in my Lanny Valerian Steel deck. It gets work, but like it's just not enough. Like, this is the nadir of Lannister, is this cycle. I think, all these cards are garbage. The lowest, I mean, Kingslayer? Oh my god. Maester at the Rock, which was busted for a long time in playtesting, and just not an effect worth... like printing. Like, this effect, the effect of Maester of the Rock is the kind of effect that is either going to be terrible, like it is here, or is going to be busted. And it's just not worth trying to figure out how to square that circle.
It is at least close enough to that line that I think there were a lot of us that were working with it after it was released, trying to get it over that busted hump before deciding it wasn't going to happen.
Yeah. It was busted in playtesting. There was a lot of work to try to tune it down. And I think if you go back and listen to Glazer and my review of this with you, Will, I think we were high on this card because from our experience of playtesting. But this is also the beginning of Barra's long climb to the top. Right, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 good Barra cards to great Barra cards. And some of these are ubiquitous on today, like Traitor to the Crown is a very important card in the Barra Assault deck. Solace, of course, makes Barra kneel. Same with Dragonstone Castle. These are all really powerful cards. So this is kind of Barra beginning to climb out. We continue to see Martell is getting really solid cards in here. Big Ariane, the Water Gardens, another ubiquitous Martell card. Host of the Bone Way. You know, these are the tools.
Planky Town Trader led to some interesting stuff.
Was this the one that was part of the combo deck?
Yes. Yeah.
Stark also gets I Am No One, super ubiquitous. Arya, let's give design A+ with Arya. This Arya is very well designed. I've skipped Night's Watch because I want to talk specifically about, like, in depth about.
Okay, I mean, there's only one card I want to talk about in Night's Watch.
Yeah, we promised we would talk about it last time, so I'm kind of just. And Ramsey, like, these are all staples.
Ramsey, I do just want to say, I think was another card that kind of just fit a perfect niche to round out the card pool, mm-hmm. both in Stark, in faction with the sacrifice theme, mm-hmm. but also the broader card pool to have this sort of march to the wall on a stick type of effect to both, you know, you can brew cool stuff with it. You can try to leverage it hard with Harrenhals and things of that nature. But I think it is also just an effective pressure valve type of tool, much like March of the Wall Plot goes. So just wanted to give Ramsey two thumbs up.
Two thumbs up. Same with Aria. Again, these cards like really land thematically, but also land on a power level. Jamie and Shaga, A+.
And also, it's really amazing when you can hit all three archetypes in some of these cards.
And then No Save Aria also really shows, I think, a good example of how to design a ubiquitous named character's card. Compare this to Asha, who just simply replaces the 5-cost Asha in like 95% of Greyjoy decks, except ones that specifically want her stand for some kind of abusable effect, but just simply like even that kind of minor use of her just kind of like fell off by the end of the game. Like this 7-cost Asha is one of the best 7-cost characters printed. And it's kind of this theme of Greyjoy that kind of, I think this Asha is the beginning of it, right? Where they just print busted versions of like already really good cards.
I think this might be the first, because even the Daenerys in this set is not just as hard of an upgrade and just overriding its prior version as Asha does.
Really? How often have you seen Big Danny since this one was printed? Since 5? Well, 5 was... I want to spend some good time talking about this Danny, so this is as good a reason as any.
I could have sworn I remembered seeing... You know, maybe I'm confusing some of those decks with 8-drop Danny decks rather
than... There were some decks that did play the 7-cost Danny, because I think there was some crossing decks that played the 7-cost Danny. But
that would make sense.
During the Reign of Terror of Martell Marine, HRD Marine, not Martell Marine, oh my god. My brain was farty, sorry. Like this Dan, because I think this lower cost Danny combined with how powerful HRD Marine is, and the fact that like an HRD deck doesn't really want to be running 7-drops, and the fact that she also makes it like a real burn deck can be built once this Danny is printed, is I think really important. I think she really does push the 7-cost Danny out. Like how frequently you just made, again, some Lord of the Crossing decks, but a lot of those just like altogether ditch the Danny Dragons burn package by the end.
Like that's fair. This one definitely, like you said, really pushes burn as an archetype, which I think a lot of Targ players were really itching to get to the point where burn was like the ends to their means rather than a supplementary means to their ends like it had been. So
what do you think of this Danny though? Like, I mean, that's my question. Like, do you think it's too much, Will?
Gosh, you know, in the end, I don't think she really panned out that way. I think when she was first released and probably for like a solid 6 months, as people got into using it, people were pretty tired of it and worried that she might be, but she definitely dialed back some. What I'm trying to remember now off the top of my head, what was really the primary motivating factor of that? What did cause that pullback?
I mean, Sea of Blood.
Well, I mean, that would do it, both crowding out in Targaryen decks, and she's a prime target to be, you know, killed. And if your engine's dead, I mean, it's not like all the burn is useless at that point, but it changes a lot.
Yeah, I'm sort of looking.
She's very, very pushed. If she was reprinted right now, do I think I would put her at this exact stat line? No.
I don't think her stat line is really her problem. I think that it's that she creates the terminal effect herself is the problem.
Gotcha.
So if you, you know, the fact that, you know, you can constantly recycle the event that just lets you shoot people, that just, you can start machine gunning three strength characters. And then, you know, Danny, of course, lets you get that event back as well, is just unbelievably obnoxious. And the ways in which she can sort of just flip board states is really annoying and frustrating, particularly when combined with like consuming flames, which is also in this set. And the fact that she also, I also think maybe if she extended burn effects, so like, you know, if a character's strength is lowered, it gets lowered an additional one, I think would be better, because one of the most annoying plays that this Danny does is like, you know, you consuming flames, my character's in the challenge, they die, cool, you then shoot my one drop, and that's dead, so now my claim soak is gone, and so now my character that was in the challenge, my claim soak, and now I have one character left that has to get claimed by your Khal Drogo challenge. Or your two Khal Drogo challenges. And the fact that she could just like really swing board states in a way that doesn't really frequently feel fair is kind of frustrating. So I think she was definitely a gift to the player base that really wanted burn, but I do think that she's overpushed, and it, I think, is her reaction is where I would retune her versus her stat line. I think 5 for 3 is, two icons is good for no keywords. I'm glad she doesn't have a keyword. Could you imagine if she had a keyword?
No attachments, maybe.
Oh God. is fine. But I think if you were to tweak her, I would tweak her her reaction. I mean, but at the same time, this is the card that makes burn what you want to play, right? It is what makes the H, you know, she alongside Dragon Pit is what makes that burn deck really work. And, you know, without her, could you ever really play a dedicated burn deck?
No, maybe not. It definitely would not feel like it gelled the same way.
Yeah.
And while you cite it as a downside, because of the kind of snowball effect, like, you know, killing something mid-range, pinging the claim soak, and then having to eat claim and that type of thing. But on the flip side, that type of play is the sort of thing that burn players tend to want to look for.
Yeah.
Those interesting interactions and that kind of snowball effect. I think if you removed that, then it's probably just better to go back to more point and click aggro style.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, no, you're right. I think, I mean, burn's just a really hard play style to balance because of its lack of interactivity. You know, and I think that Danny is a product of an era. I think burn is under pushed, you could say, right? Up to this point, as like it's something that you're doing on your own. You know, it was alongside a strong aggro package. Like Dracarys was designed to punish your opponent for trying to interact with you as an aggro deck in a lot of those crossing decks, including Reinhardt's World Championship deck. But it was sort of like a supplement. Dracarys you know, easily one of the most busted cards in the history of the game. It's still very, it's more of a support card than like your whole game plan. And Dragon Is No Slave also, you know, wasn't really a burn card. It was, you know, somewhat of a challenge control card, and what didn't see a lot of a huge amount of play if memory serves before Danny came out. And it's really, you know, Danny that just makes burn for its own sake possible. And I definitely appreciate that there's a lot of people who want that, but it is a extremely negative play experience to play against it when it gets out of hand. And I think that Danny really does. I mean, just by herself, she, like, there's what, one more frequently played burn card. It's also in the set. I guess Drogon is also, but he's not. Yeah. He doesn't really. I mean, he does. I have been killed by someone Drogoning a 5-strike character and then playing, you know, a burn event, playing Dragon Is No Slave on something and pinging the 5-strike character dead. I have had that happen to me. It was not fun. but it's not frequently there. I think the fact that a whole theme as an archetype rides and dies with her shows just sort of how powerful she is.
Fair. I think you've brought me around.
Final point, because we are getting long in the tooth here. Drown God. This is where the engines of Drown God are here. Right. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4 Drown God cards in this set. I mean, theoretically, we always wanted to make Kingsmoot also work. In Drown God, but it never did.
So this is the other tribal to come in a cycle. Then I was too focused on the 7 earlier, but we also got Drown God here at the same time.
Yeah, and Drown God is, I mean, I think that it should be at this point pretty clear that I missed Driftwood Cudgel. So there's 1, 2, 3. Cudgel.
Whoops.
4, 5 cards. The cudgel. The cudgel. Oh, when that was legal. I think that Drown God's way it plays with the dead pile is one of the most interesting things that Danny ever did in this game. Now, you can argue, I think that the engine of Drowned Disciple is too much. And there definitely should have been more ways to interact with some of the Drown God interactions printed. But I think at its core, this is one of the most creative spaces that Danny ever explored. And I think it was probably a shame to make it entirely about passive power rather than gaining some like incremental advantages or cool challenge phase tricks, like Vince can be a cool challenge phase trick when he comes out of the dead pile. But I think that at its core, I really, really, really do appreciate that Danny was willing to push thrones here. But there's definitely, of course, the fact that it's almost entirely passive power that is the payoff for that push was clearly a mistake.
I think that's kind of where I land on Drown God.
I agree that the concept is super cool. It is, like you said, a good example of Danny kind of flexing some chops here. As a probably Shaga at heart the most of any archetype, I always am very intrigued by this type of thing, and it feels interesting and splashy. But Thrones has let's say poor history with combo oriented decks and play styles, and gosh, so it just feels weird. On the one hand, you want a designer to be pushing envelopes and trying out new directions and such, or otherwise the game is just going to get stale. People get bored, they move on. But also, the designer and playtest, of course, needs to help with this, but needs to make sure that things fit kind of within the framework of the game. And I'm not sure the way Drowned God played out, if it really fit the way Thrones operates. It just, even aside from community opinion, the setup of the game, the challenges, trying to get up to 15 power has never really lent itself to combo feeling like it had a home. So,
I mean, we can argue. I mean, it's probably worth at some point sitting down and talking about combo and Thrones. I don't think maybe at the end of the episode here is, as we move towards the end of the episode, is maybe really the place. Because we're still one next cycle as Vince? Or is Vince already out? No, Vince isn't out, right?
No, Vince is not yet out at the time this came out. Let's see. Too many drowned cards. He is drowned fanatic.
Yes.
Yeah. Streets of King's Landing. So that is the middle of the next cycle.
Okay, cool. Well, that might be a good place to talk about it, because that is, of course, where Drowned God like really cranks up. Sure. And also the printing of once you get the Sun cards. In fact, it's really the Sun package that makes Drowned God the most obnoxious, because once it gets the control tools to really slow the game down and force the mid-range players to play on the Drowned God player's terms, Drowned God is just going to beat you if you give it enough time, right? Even if it's not just sitting there comboing, like, really fast. Like, it just, like, sets a clock on the game. And the Sun cards force the opponents to play on Drowned God's terms, and that's obnoxious and too powerful. So I have sort of 2 points, though, Will. I think the problem at the end of the day is I really wish that there had been more interaction printed with the dead pile that tried to heat out Drowned God while also paying off your opponent's, like, your opponent's themes, like a Targaryen card that, you know, is basically like Scavenging Ooze, the magic card that, you know, you paid a gold, removed a card from the dead pile from the game, you know, gained some kind of small benefit, right? You could gain plus, like a Tyrell, perfect Tyrell card, right? Could be like a Septon, some kind of Septon, you know, gets plus one strength. You know, you pay one gold, remove a card from a dead pile from the game, gains plus one strength until end of the challenge. Even if you want to make sure it's balanced, end of the challenge, right? That could just eat up what the Drowned God player is doing, right? And there's also interplay there of, am I first player? Am I second player? That kind of stuff, you know? There's just not, like, Burning the Dead is the only real attempt to really do that. And I think that if there had been more attempts to sort of, like, really treat the dead pile as a zone of interaction for all factions, the fact that we never got a dead pile matters, like, sub-theme in one of the cycles is also a little weird. Because I think you could definitely think of like 3 or 4 other factions that not dealing with recursion the way Greyjoy does, but you could interact in cool ways with the dead pile is something that they could have done. And I think the other thing is also, it's not inevitable that cool things with the dead pile have to be passive power. And that's one of the things that I think I hope that future designers really think about is just because that's what Drowned God was, doesn't mean that that's what any new Drowned God cards they need to print need to be. There can be challenge-based ways of using the dead pile to build a board and all that kind of stuff. Kind of like the way in which that four drop that's in the Stark box kind of like plays around with the dead pile. You know, like really bringing things back, and Vince is another example of this, that it doesn't have to be, okay, I bring something back from the dead pile, I gain 5 power. That doesn't have to be what these kinds of interactions are all about. It was a specific decision by Danny's, one that I think, you know, overall could have been healthy if it had been like really considered as something that is going to be a pillar of the game, but it wasn't. It was treated like an abnormality, and there weren't cards printed to try to hate it out really aggressively. And so we ended up where we were, and it had to be banned.
There we go. Yeah, I mean, I agree that there is probably more room to experiment, particularly with hate cards as a pressure valve, instead of going all the way to kind of exterior FAQ-based means. So, yeah.
Finally, Ratcook, right? We said we were going to talk about it.
Yeah, I think Ratcook is probably the best note to end on.
Yeah, I mean, that's why Kyle's not on the show anymore, right? He quit the game after he got Ratcooked.
It ended Kyle. Yeah, it really did. And here, this is the payoff for Stewards, which I think we were talking about them not really having in the Night's Watch box.
Yeah, and I love Ratcook. I've never really had a huge amount of success like playing Ratcook myself. But I love Ratcook decks. I love Ratcook players. Much love to my team Night's Watch for JND2 that I was a member of. There were some sweet Ratcook decks in that field. I think it's a really cool payoff for Stewards. I think it's actually one of the better designed theft cards, because it makes their text box blank. It doesn't kill them at the end, although there are ways, of course, you can kill your opponent's creatures, sure, characters and stuff.
Or discard.
And at 2 gold, like it's really well priced for an event, right? Like the 2 gold is kind of like the high end of a playable event. And so the cost is in demanding that you invest in Stewards versus like pay X gold to steal the character, right? Which in many ways says, okay, I have to have some kind of event cancel is my only way to interact with Ratcook, while there are multiple ways to sort of prevent your opponent from getting a good Ratcook. It could be Valoring them. It could be Valador Harrising them. It could be playing Wildfire. It could be, you know, burning a couple of the key Stewards down. And of course, none of the Stewards are except for a couple of them later, you know, like Clytus and John and the 7-cost John from the box, very few of them are at like a high power level. So they're playing these gunky cards for the amazing thing that is the Ratcook. Good job, Danny. This is one of the best and most fun Night's Watch steal effects.
I hate to come around on this, but I think I do sort of agree. I think the issue that just made it feel bad to some folks is that character theft, I think it's inherently one of the most NPE effects in any card game. And I don't mean NPE in the shorthand for broken or overpowered. Those are not all strictly synonymous. I only mean that it generates a very negative experience for the player whose characters are stolen. And I think Ratcook just kind of hit at a time when there were a lot of these coming out in Night's Watch. I understand the Nedley thematic aspect of going there and recruiting people, but from a practical aspect of making sure your players enjoy their games, the amount of negative emotion generated by a lot of playable steal effects is much higher than the satisfaction generated by the person utilizing them. So the rat cook, I think, is probably one of the least offenders. It just felt like kind of collateral damage wrapped up in the bulk that Night's Watch had.
Yeah, I think it definitely kind of suffered from Builder's sins, because, you know, Builder's was such a non-traditional way of playing Thrones that a lot of, like, you could say, like, mid-range enthusiast players didn't like that play style, and the fact that they then got a second deck that also doesn't play the game, out of the tin mid-range thing. And in some ways, Rat Cook punishes you more for trying to play that mid-range game. Like, if you got a Balon with 6 power and your opponent steals it and wins the game, which I've definitely seen Rat Cook players do, or if your mace is stolen, although, you know, if your mace is stolen by Rat Cook, you kind of deserve it. And I say that as someone who has had their mace stolen by Rat Cook. It definitely was the combination of the two, right? They're kind of like 1-2 punches to, like, really, they were decks that attacked the mid-range game plan that was so dominant up to the point in which the Night's Watch box and then Rat Cook really, and Rat Cook really wasn't consistent. Poor Kyle kind of got the bleeding edge of it.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, the deck kind of made a splash and then kind of faded away until a few other cards were printed, and people figured out that the best Rat Cook deck was Banner Wolf. But there was the 1-2 punch of, you know, mid-range had kind of only been the only way to really successfully play Thrones or aggro, and these are all challenge out of the tin aggro / rush. There hadn't been these kind of, like, not in the tin decks that were really, really prominent and really, really consistent. And the fact that you got Builders and Rat Cook within a short period of time where they were really felt in the meta, kind of just, that's a lot for players, and is going to just sort of be like, oh, you're not playing Builders. Cool. That this could be a fun game. And then they steal your 6 power Balon and sacrifice him to Ramsey. And you're like, oh, never mind.
Yeah.
So maybe if it just had one, things would have been a little bit better. But in the end, by the end of the game, the hero was Rat Cook. I'm just going to say it. But
I mean, there's those negative experiences, just like I was saying.
All right. I think that covers just about everything. I think we just want to say overall, I do think the power level is, again, very high in this set and very well spread out, except for Lannister. I think a lot of factions got a lot of really cool cards here, and these are staples. I mean, I think at least one card from each faction, except Lannister, sees play up to the point in which the game leaves the FFG era.
Yeah. I think overall, this is a great cycle. It's just not a great bestow cycle.
Absolutely, that's completely fair. All right, well, I think next time we're talking about green cards, right, Will?
Oh, finally. Finally, we get there. We've been talking about it, we've been hinting at it, so to speak, for I feel like the last 3 of these, so we will finally actually get there.
And we really do move into a new age in some ways with the printing of mace, and the combo era. I think it might be worth sitting and talking. Maybe we'll wait until Vince, but or maybe mace will be worth it to talk about. Maybe we can just open up with, like, combo and really talk about the different variants of it, because it's definitely something that, I think, what year did this come out?
20. I think the Tyrell box came out at the end of 2017. Right? Because Night of Flowers was definitely in the combo deck. Right.
Yeah, that sounds right. The counting backward, I think that's right.
Because I went to 2 IO Worlds, 2017, the year Sandy won, and you were in the top 8, right? And then 2018, the next year. And this this was just legal, right? Because I remember we bought it at Worlds, and we're building decks in the car ride down.
Yeah. Yep, it had just dropped.
Yeah, it had just dropped. So that would have been 2017. So Combo was just starting up. We were just entering Combo Winter when this was released. So it's probably worth sitting down and really thinking about it, because we got Six Maids in a Pool is in here, Melia Bitterbridge, all these cards that everybody
wants. We're just going to do the box if you keep going, Roy.
I know. So.
Oh, man. With that, dear listeners, we're going to leave you on tenterhooks waiting for that analysis. But that would definitely put us in the danger zone.
Oh, it definitely would. It definitely would.